Okay, we'll assume it's friendly anyway, okay?
There's two of them, and they've stayed in the exact same spot the whole time. They're out solar, like I say that.
Oh my god, I hope that's a plane. Oh Jesus, please be a plane. Oh, please. Well, Lisa, are you ready for this?
That what the hell is that midway across the Hudson River? It was a perfectly circular disc.
Well, the thing just hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I saw it.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that the days like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Good evening. This is edition 404 of Strange Days Indeed, the program that observes and reports on the phenomena that surround one of the greatest mysteries that humanity has ever faced. UFOs, unidentified flying objects. Tonight, Dave Ferlot with his take on it. Another visit from David Cherniak, who's the Canadian documentary filmmaker. He reports in from Seattle on his 4-month North American odyssey in an RV gathering interviews for his current project, UFOs and the Politics of Reality. And after the news at the top of the hour, Wayne St. John, who's in studio with me. Evening, Wayne.
Good evening, Errol.
Good evening, Wayne.
And audience all the way to Montreal.
And around the world.
And around the world.
Yes.
There are more
people listening around the world than there are on the sticks.
Wonderful.
Here in Toronto and in Montreal. Did you know that?
I didn't know that. That's quite amazing.
I just made it up.
Oh, well, you know, we'll go with that. Let's go with it.
But there are a lot of people out there.
Yeah, for sure.
And people sitting by their pools in their winter woolies in Australia.
Indeed, and there's a lot of good stuff to tell them tonight, too.
Oh, yes, there is,
juicy.
Too. The big buzz around the UFO field over the past week or so has been about Buzz Aldrin, the Apollo 11 crew member, who, along with Neil Armstrong and Mike Collins, saw an object close to their craft on the way to that first historic landing on the moon. Aldrin talked about their sighting in a documentary, Apollo 11, The Untold Story, which is also known as First on the Moon, The Untold Story, which aired last week in the United Kingdom on Channel 5. Buzz was a guest on a widely heard late-night program this week and clarified his rumored UFO sighting. He told listeners that what he actually saw were bright flashes at night, which at the time were quite mysterious. But on a later mission, he said these flashes were identified as high-velocity Z particles and nothing related to an ET craft. That's what he told those radio listeners this week. Now, from the television documentary Apollo 11, The Untold Story, here's how Buzz Aldrin described those flashes.
I remembered as I began to make an attempt to go to sleep, all of a sudden I would see a flash somewhere, and before I could turn or get my eye on the flash, it was gone. Now, the first impression was, well, something just penetrated the inside of the spacecraft. And so I asked Neil and Mike, and Neil said, yeah, I saw about 100 of them. The conclusion was that they're high Z particles, Z meaning a heavy particle at high velocity, that penetrate the spacecraft, penetrate the individual, cause some potential damage to nerve cells and brain cells, but only over a long period of time, evidently.
Damage to brain cells over a period of time? Strange, but also in that documentary, Apollo 11, The Untold Story, Buzz Aldrin described on camera an earlier sighting 2 days out from Earth on that famous mission to the moon.
There was something out there that was close enough to be observed, and what could it be? Mike decided he thought he could see it in the telescope, and he was able to do that. And when it was in one position, it had a series of ellipses. But when you made it real sharp, it was sort of L-shaped. That didn't tell us very much. Obviously, the three of us were not going to blurt out, "Hey, Houston, we got something moving alongside of us, and we don't know what it is. You know, can you tell us what it is?" We weren't about to do that, because we know that those transmissions would be heard by all sorts of people, and who knows what somebody would have demanded that we turn back because of aliens or whatever the reason is. So we didn't do that, but we did decide, we just cautiously asked Houston, how far away was the S-4B?
Do you have any idea where the S-4B is with respect to us?
Apollo 11, Houston, the S-4B is about 6,000 nautical miles from you now, over.
A few moments later, well, they came back and said something like it was 6,000 miles away because of the maneuver. So we really didn't think we were looking at something that far away. So we decided that after a while of watching it, it was time to go to sleep and not to talk about it anymore until we came back in debriefing.
So what we have here is a public admission by the second man to walk on the moon, a decorated former military officer, that all three astronauts saw a UFO on their epic space journey and downplayed it until they successfully returned to Earth to report it during their flight debriefing, and never talking about it again until Buzz Aldrin sat in front of British TV cameras last year, and then on radio this week denying that he'd ever seen anything remotely extraterrestrial during the moon mission. The question is, why? Dr. David Baker worked for NASA and the U.S. Department of Defense for 30 years. He was involved with mission planning on projects such as Apollo and the shuttle, has written more than 60 books, and is currently the editor of Jane's Aircraft Upgrades and Aerospace Review. A heavily credentialed scientist, one might say. He was right there at NASA as a senior scientist during the Apollo 11 flight, and was also in that documentary, Apollo 11, The Untold Story. Here's what David Baker had to say in that documentary.
NASA knew very little about the object reported by the Apollo 11 crew. It was obviously an unidentified flying object, but such objects were not uncommon, and the history of even Earth orbit space flights going back over the previous years indicated that several crews saw objects. The possibility that you might encounter aliens in space has to be considered in a very sensible and positive and realistic way. There are a lot of people within the program who went off later and became convinced that UFOs existed. And that led to some concern on NASA's part, where they got the agreement of the crew never to publicly talk about these things for fear of ridicule.
Did you catch that? But such objects were not uncommon, and the history of even Earth orbit space flights going back over the previous years indicated that several crews saw objects. Now, this is from Dr. David Baker, who worked for NASA and the U.S. Department of Defense for 30 years. Now, so much for NASA's denial that they have no knowledge about UFOs. And then just today, the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia ran a story titled, "One Giant Blunder for Mankind, How NASA Lost Moon Pictures," written by Richard Macy, which reads, "The heart-stopping moments when Neil Armstrong took his first tentative steps onto another world are defining images of the 20th century, grainy, fuzzy, and unforgettable. But just 37 years after Apollo 11, it is feared that the magnetic videotapes that recorded the first moonwalk, beamed to the world via three tracking stations, including Park's famous dish, have gone missing at NASA's Goddard Space Center in Maryland. A desperate search has begun amid concerns the tapes will disintegrate to dust before they can be found." Now, it's not widely known that the Apollo 11 television broadcast from the moon was actually a high-quality transmission, far sharper than the blurry version relayed instantly to the world on that July day in 1969. Among those battling to unscramble the mystery is John Sarkisian, a CSIRO scientist stationed at Parks for a decade. We're working on the assumption that they still exist, Mr. Sarkisian said. Your guess is as good as mine as to where they are. Mr. Sarkisian began researching the role of Parks in Apollo 11's mission in 1997, before the movie The Dish was made. However, when he later contacted NASA colleagues to ask about the tapes, they couldn't find them. People may have thought we have tapes of the moonwalk. We don't need these, said the scientist, who hopes a new intensive hunt will locate them. If they can be found, he proposes making digitalized copies to treat the world to a very different view of history. But the searchers may be running out of time. The only equipment on which the original analog tapes can be decoded is at Goddard Center, set to close in October, raising fears that even if they are found before they deteriorate, copying them will be impossible. We want the public to see it the way the moonwalk was meant to be seen, said Mr. Sarkisian. There will only ever be one first moonwalk. Originally stored at Goddard, the tapes were moved in 1970 to the U.S. National Archives. No one knows why, but in 1984, about 700 boxes of spaceflight videotapes were returned to Goddard. We have the documents to say they were withdrawn, but no one knows exactly where they went. Many people involved have retired or died. Also among tapes feared missing are the original recordings of the other five Apollo moon landings. The format used by the original pictures beamed from the moon was not compatible with commercial technology used by TV networks. So the images received at parks and at tracking stations near Canberra and in California were played on screens mounted in front of conventional television cameras. The quality of what you saw on TV at home was substantially degraded in the process, Mr. Sarkisian said, creating the ghostly images of Armstrong and Aldrin that strained the eyes of hundreds of millions of people watching around the world. That report from the Sydney Morning Herald in Australia today, so not only are the Apollo 11 high-quality videos missing, but so are those other Apollo missions to the moon. And at least one of the missions is rumored to have landed close to an established moon base. That's right, a moon base. But whose base that might have been is anyone's guess. Is somebody or someone yanking our string really hard? Hard on the heels of the Buzz Aldrin story, NASA confesses to losing high-quality videos of Earth's first landings on another body in space? Where does this leave the evidence of doctored pictures from Mars? Strange days, indeed.
These are strange days, indeed, on UFO News Radio. Here with his take on it, here's Dave Furlong.
The endless question about UFOs seems to be, are they from another planet, piloted by a race of alien beings, and why are they here? I noticed when I signed into Yahoo Canada this morning that this question appears to have gotten out there as well. And on the UFO updates list, it always comes out either as a post from a contactee or from someone speaking about previous UFO crashes and the recovery of dead, dying, and live alien creatures. I've given a lot of thought as to why UFOs and their extraterrestrial occupants are coming to this planet. And from that thought, I've developed a theory, but it is based on a lot of ifs, so bear with me. If, or when, we develop the technology that will allow us to break the barriers of space and allow us to travel to other solar systems and distant galaxies, there is no doubt that we will encounter planets inhabited by cognizant species. Now, let's imagine for a second that we discover a planet that has a dominant species, humanoid, meaning they walk on two legs, they have two arms, they have a head, and they're developing on their own evolutionary scale. Now, for whatever reason, that's probably where the similarity to us ends. This race could have only one ear or three ears. They might have two eyes or any other combination of senses that we have and potentially additional ones. Now, if this society was discovered by us and they were, say, at a technological level similar to ours of the period 2 to 3,000 BC, we would study them. we would pose no, they'd pose no threat to us because basically they'd be incapable of fighting us with spears and arrows. And let's not forget something. We would not be sending craft loaded with scientists and technicians on a weekly basis or a monthly basis. We weren't capable of doing that with the moon. So surely we would not be able to do it with a planet in a different solar system or galaxy. We would mount missions to Planet X as best we could, but probably those missions would be months or even a year apart. And who would we send after we made first contact with this planet of mystery? We'd send anthropologists to study the people who are the dominant species. We'd send zoologists to study the animal life. We'd send botanists to study the plant life. If our people came into contact with the inhabitants of this planet, they'd probably be thought of as gods. And, well, we'd either nurture that or we'd ignore it. We'd nurture it because it would allow us to get a little more knowledge of this race, and we might simply ignore it because we'd be uncomfortable taking on such a role. Either way, it would still allow us the flexibility of studying what we want to discover, and we'd continue on. Now, would we be smart enough to let their culture go on without interference, or would we perhaps bring back some of the inhabitants so we could study them longer and closer here on Earth? Now, I shudder to think that if we discovered something in the genetic code of that intelligent species, we would probably abduct some of those people and bring them back here. I mean, who'd miss a few dozen from among the millions of inhabitants on the planet? And you have to remember, Columbus brought back natives from the New World in chains to present to Queen Isabella. And those of you thinking that we would not do that, think again. What would be the easiest way for us to learn how to communicate or understand what those people are saying? Simple. By abducting some of them, teaching them how to communicate in our language, and having them translate for us. The study of this new world would go on probably for decades, because every time we went there, we would discover something new about that planet, and with every journey to there, we would risk further and further chance encounters with the intelligent inhabitants. But here's the one caveat to this as well. When our craft returned from a journey to that planet, we would do everything conceivably possible to ensure that we weren't carrying anything home with us that could be some potential virus that could harm us or the planet. I wonder, however, if we would pay as much attention to try to keep from polluting that planet with our viri and diseases. Thinking about that, it makes me wonder at some of the new diseases and viri that have surfaced on our planet. I wonder if perhaps some of those may not be originally from this Earth. But if you agree with me that if we were to discover such a world, that we would be studying it in great detail, can it be any different for a spacefaring race to come here and do likewise? If UFOs exist and are piloted by beings from another world, how can we possibly wonder why they are here? They are here to study and learn all they can about this planet and its occupants. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange Dave, indeed.
Thank you, Dave. We're crunched for time. We'll talk to you next week.
Not a problem.
Good one. Thank you.
Thanks.
Let's head out to Seattle, Washington. And David Cherniak, Canadian documentary filmmaker, is there, and he's on his four-month North American odyssey in an RV, gathering interviews for his current project, UFOs and the Politics of Reality. Talk about 6 days on the road, David Cherniak.
Oh, yes. It's now been a month, Errol, and the RV requires upholstery cleaning and a good wash. It's working well, you know. It's working well as a home on the road and a good way to shoot this. We've even been shooting some of the green screen interviews inside the RV.
You've got green velvet drape up or something for that?
No, I have a Photoflex that hangs from a curtain and covers one side of the RV to the other when the slide is out. It works very, very well.
Oh, nice. Are you editing on the road as well?
No time to do that. No time to even review the thing. I've covered a lot of miles. I've done 6,252, for lack of a better figure, miles already, and we're at the coast, heading down into the Seattle area.
The last time we talked, you were on the outskirts of Chicago, and you were going to go and see the guys at the Center for UFO Studies there.
Right. We did the Center for UFO Studies. We scanned half their library. Really, all went through their files. It took a day and a half. I gave them a whole list of cases, and they brought out about 6 feet of files, and we scanned for a day and a half. Then from there, wound my way up indirectly down to southern Minnesota and did an interview with Jerry Clark. Then back to Minneapolis and picked up Tom Tolleen, and we headed for Minot. Tom's got a big paper of his investigations into the Minot 67 incident with the B-52 coming up. And we had permission from the Air Force. So we were taken onto the active runway with all the B-52s at Minot. And I filmed Tom wandering around the B-52s. Went inside the belly of the beast, Darrell. Went inside the bomb bay where they kept those things, where they still keep those things. And sat there and talked with Tom. It was quite the experience.
We're talking atomic weapons, those things.
Yeah, yes. Ancient atomic weapons. I learned a thing about B-52s, other than the fact that they really loomed large in my imagination. They're enormous. You go up to them and you notice the skin is wrinkled. You know, it looks like a wrinkled old man.
It's
you know,
an old
the
bomb.
Metal, right? And I was really wondering whether that affected the aerodynamics of the thing. The crew chief for the maintenance was telling me, no, in fact, once you get above 12,000 feet with the pressurized cabin, the skin pops out and becomes flat. So
that's bizarre.
It's like the B-52 gets an erection there.
Oh, nice talk, David. The B-52 incident that you're referring to that you went specifically there for, in a nutshell?
In a nutshell, a B-52 was returning from a training mission to Minot in 67 when some security personnel downrange from the runway about 20 miles had seen a strange light flying over one of the missile installations. This B-52 was asked to check it out. They had it on their radar scope. Tom's got the pictures that were shot off the radar scope, and the object did a circle right around the B-52. They didn't see anything at that point other than the radar thing. Mm-hmm. They were returning to land when quite freaked by the whole incident. When some general came on, nobody really knows who or from where, and asked them to circle around again and to see whether they could get an eye contact, which they did, and saw on the ground a huge craft that was composed of two parts, kind of a sphere and a crescent-like object that appeared to be kind of a command center. This is according to the reports that Tom has collected from interviewing the entire crew. This was the incident that was portrayed in
the Peter Jennings, yes.
So we did a little filming on the runway and then went on to Malmstrom, where we were again welcomed very politely and very nicely by the public affairs people at Malmstrom, who took us around to a missile launch facility. The missiles just absolutely dot the planes out there. They're very innocuous looking, but once you've seen one, you can recognize them, and you start to see them, like, everywhere. There are, like, hundreds of these things throughout Montana and North Dakota.
Yeah.
They're in farmers' fields. You can drive right up to them. Of course, you mustn't rattle the fence. Well, you can rattle the fence, but if you cross over the fence, all hell tends to break.
Yes.
You suddenly have a bunch of guys with M16s pointed at your head. You
know? Oh, my. It's like Area 51. Did you actually get into one of the silos at Malmstrom?
No, we didn't get into the silo, and the camera equipment wasn't approved to go down into the control center. So what we had to content ourselves with was shooting in the museum, but it worked out very well because the crew chief, retired crew chief, runs the museum there, was very entertaining on camera. He went about showing me how all the procedures that were required to launch one of the Minutemen, which require two people and a fairly elaborate sequence of actions and keys. And I said to him, so it really looks like you can't have any lunatics down here. He motioned for me, you know, like across the throat, cut, jokingly, and said, no, we can get them down here too. But apparently it doesn't just require one launch control facility to launch. It requires a whole number of them in sync to do it. So.
Or one UFO hovering over the control center.
Well, that's what we were doing. We're going to be talking to Robert Salas and to Jim Klotz, who wrote the book with Robert, who's in the Seattle area. So he's one of the people who are talking.
Yeah.
I'm also hoping to rent a plane and fly the Kenneth Arnold route. Where I'm sitting, which is in Janet Coley's living room, we're talking to Janet about something else.
Oh, she'd been on the program
and looking,
here, yeah?
Yeah, and looking at Mount Baker, where, you know, these things came down when he was flying. He figured they came down in the direction of Baker, crossed in front of Rainier, and he clocked them from Rainier to Mount Adams. So I'm hoping to fly that exactly, you know.
That'll be another interesting. Last week, you were somewhere on the West Coast.
Yes, on the way to Vancouver, where we talked to Martin Jacek about Yukon 1995, I think, or 99, I can't remember.
Was that the enormous...
The huge...
Kilometer-size craft.
Yes, he estimates between 500 meters and 2 kilometers big craft.
Astounding story.
31 different people in 4 separate groups along a 100-kilometer stretch of the Klondike Highway.
And if listeners want to read a copy of that, that's available at ufobc.ca. Where are you headed next?
Oh. Down to Seattle, and then after that, south to Portland. To talk to Delbert Newhouse and Junior, the son, and the father down in Portland.
They are?
If you remember the Tremont in Utah film back in the early 50s, Del Newhouse was the person, the Navy photographer who took it. The son was 13 years old. He was in the car. And he got out of the car and was looking at these objects. Now, I can tell you one interesting thing he said that I don't think has appeared in the written record. He said as he was watching them, he said, that pairs of objects were moving as if they were connected.
Now, where have we heard that before? It's becoming more and more common.
Okay. Well, this happened, you know.
Pairs and trios all moving.
This is broad daylight.
You certainly are reinforcing the education that you gave yourself.
Well,
UFO
through
history.
Through actually talking to the people who lived the history.
And I trust you're shooting way more footage than you're going to need for the sake of archives later.
Absolutely am.
Yeah, I'm sure Wendy Connors would be really pleased to hear that. And
Well, we intend to see Wendy down in Albuquerque. So after Seattle and Portland, stop in McMinnville, and then south to the Bay Area, we'll be talking to lots of people who you've heard of. Then down the California coast as far as Mount Palomar Gardens. That may ring some familiar bells.
Yes.
And then out into the desert.
David, we are out of time, my
old
buddy.
Oh, God, time flies.
David Cherniak, we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay.
Good night,
thanks,
sir. Happy days on the road. Wayne St. John is in studio with me. Wayne has a somewhat different perspective on a lot of the things that this program covers and has spent a fair amount of time talking with various contactees, as you will gather. So Dave lives here in Toronto. He was contacted by beings that were seen coming out of a craft.
Right.
Down there at Queen and Leslie, south of Queen Street here in Toronto.
Right. Just south of Laneway South, which brings you right to the Maple Leaf Forever Park.
That's a lovely name, isn't it?
Yes.
And Dave has been having ongoing or had ongoing experiences.
When he was a child in teenage years, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Basically, coming with clear memory of being around these people that came from a spacecraft. Sometimes there were several of them up in the sky. There'd be a flash of light, and they'd appear. One day, I guess he was probably 7. Davy Crockett had, and he really wanted to complete his outfit, and he really wanted to get a gun.
Oh.
It was sitting in a store near them, and his mother finally bought him the gun. So he walks into the Maple Leaf Forever Park, by himself, and he's got the gun, and he's shooting Cap. And then suddenly he turns around, and there's one of the women from the craft walking towards him in a uniform. And she said to him, "Where did you get that gun?" He explained, and she said, "Well, you're not getting out of the park with that gun. So you're not going to be shooting guns." He, of course, was taken aback and was kind of upset, thought something was going to come up as he was getting rangy. She has a way of getting his attention. She pulled out a watch, totally hypnotizing him, allowing her to feed him information.
Now, when you say a watch, a pocket watch?
Like a pocket
watch. On a chain?
Yeah, on a chain, yeah.
Oh, the,
yeah.
The old hypnotist
The old hypnotist
number,
thing,
yeah.
Yeah, it worked great. But he knew he was in trouble every time he saw the watch come out. So she said, "Well, you're not going to have the gun. That's it. We don't want you to have them." He turns around and a couple of girls are coming. He gets concerned that these little girls are going to see the woman and he has to explain her in her costume. One of the girls, Margaret, comes up to him and says, "Dave, who was that lady?" He said, "Oh, I don't know. I really don't know." Her seeing the lady actually made it real for him. Suddenly she was actually, this was real. It was a figment of his imagination. The lady walks away into the distance and disappears. Margaret, little Margaret, is carrying a pail, picking berries. So he was thinking of himself in the Alamo and Davy Crockett and how Davy Crockett fought to the last thing with the butt of his rifle and all that stuff. So he takes his gun and he holds the barrel and he swats the can, and the gun, of course, broke in a million pieces. The thought came to him, well, she said, "I wasn't going to leave the field with that gun." So that's another
Dave's story.
And a little moraler.
And I'm sure there are a lot of people out there who are looking forward to hearing David's voice in describing some of his experiences.
Indeed,
and
so.
I know that'll come up in the not-too-distant future.
For sure, it will.
Joining us on the line from his home in New Jersey is another one of Wayne St. John's contactee friends.
Indeed.
But at Riley's site, it says, Riley Martin says it all started when he was 7. They took little Riley aboard an alien spacecraft to a huge mothership, planet Saturn.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
And Riley's started life as a sharecropper's son.
That's correct, yeah. And he became a fighter, actually, kind of a street fighter later on.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Not as a pro boxer.
Well,
we can ask him when he joins us.
He'll tell you about it, for sure.
Okay, good.
He was quite a fighter.
Yeah. This is Riley Martin on the line. Good evening, Riley.
Good evening, Riley.
Good evening, Wayne. And
Errol. Errol's.
And Errol, yes.
Yeah, you could call me, I don't know, you could call me Bob or Frank or Howard or, you know, just as long as you don't call me Johnson.
Okay. Thanks for having me on, fellows.
Good to have you on.
Great to have you.
You've had an interesting life. I mean, most of the people that we've had on this program who have had direct contact have been abductees and really haven't been too thrilled about that whole experience. But you've gone another route in all of this, or you've been taken in another route.
Sure. My experiences, gentlemen, began at the age of 7 in northeastern Arkansas. I had saw lights above the river 3 nights in a row. On the 3rd night, the lights were so close until they illuminated my room. I had 2 brothers that slept in this big room with me. But for some reason, I could not awaken them. I could shake them. I could not awaken them, which was unusual. On the 3rd night, I heard a voice saying, "Friend Martin, come out. We have need to speak with you." So I got up and put my clothing on and went out and got my dog, Brown Boy. And we went down to the river to investigate these lights. As I came through a cane break, I saw the ship. I felt the static electricity in my hair, the leaves moving, and it upset the dog.
I guess.
Right. And the ship was there in a clearing, standing about 4 meters above the ground. It looked like polished silver with rings of lights running in opposite directions, kind of like a wheel in the middle of a wheel. Presently, the dome of the ship, though it looked metal, it literally cleared up like glass, and I could see 2 people beings standing there looking down at me. Then it occurred to me, guys, I better get out of here, you know. And at the moment I had that thought, I was hit, bam, with a blue-white light, and I could not move. But now my trusty dog, Brown Boy, could move. And I looked back, and I saw his ears flapping as he went back up the hill. He left me. And I guess he said, hey, I don't want to deal with this.
Well, guess not.
You handle it. And he cut out on me, though he was a great dog. I mean, mm-hmm. he wasn't afraid of anything in life, in a way. You handle that. I'm going to get help. You know. Presently, there was a brilliant light right beneath the center of the ship. And out of that light walked two beings, one a little shorter than the other. They were wearing bubble helmets. The taller one, he had on a blue jumpsuit. On his left breast was a seven-pointed star with a fat H in the middle. The shorter one, whom I learned was the female, had on a greenish, iridescent green jumpsuit. And on her left chest was a fish, and in the middle of it was a little fat H. So they came and they got me by each arm. And they said, Friend Martin, we have come again. I said, well, who are you? Who are you? And they were speaking to me telepathically, though I could hear them well. And they said, don't you remember us? From there, near the Tigris and Euphrates in the Nile River Valley, when your ancestors did build the Pyram or the pyramids and the Valley of Giza, don't you remember us? I said, well, it's kind of coming back to me a little bit. And I say, hey, I can't go, man, because you have to ask my mother. She'll worry about me. And they said, don't worry. We shall soon bring you home again. Mm. And they took me aboard the ship. Now, as we went up into a circular chamber, they told me, wait. And the door whizzed open, and they walked out and left me in. And around me was thousands of little bitty lights dancing over my body, and I could actually feel those lights like warm water. Presently, there was a mist, like that. And at first, it kind of irritated the nose, but then it became very pleasant. I understand this is probably some type of a decontamination process that they put you through. And also, I looked down, and I was completely nude. Now, I don't know how I got nude, but I guess it was some type of biomolecular dispersal or something. They brought me in, and they laid me on this table. And
Were you calm? Were you calm at this point?
No, I was afraid. Was afraid at that time because I was actually weakened. So to speak.
I
couldn't put up a fight. And there were two very unattractive taller beings that I learned later were called Stagians. Now, they are ugly but gentle. Perhaps some of the nicest aliens there is as far as peace is concerned, peaceful countenance. Anyway, the male and female were standing near my feet. I heard them talking. Ola nataka pakaratu. And they say, well, you are a very strong boy. And even you could harm us, for as you can see, we are quite fragile. I said, I ain't going to hurt you, man. Let me up, you know. So they did and set me, fitted me with a kind of a little robe and set me in a recliner. They took me to their mothership, which is located between Saturn and one of its great moons. And I stayed there 3 days before being returned unharmed. Now, realize, gentlemen, that I would not know of these things for 35 years. They did not uplink my memory, even though they had visited me roughly every 11 years, no matter where I was.
Mm.
And I stayed with them periods ranging from 7 to sometime 9 days and what have you.
They gave you a screen memory so you didn't remember any of this.
Right.
Right.
Now, and they had observed me all those years.
So did you get a good whopping when you got home after that first trip?
No, when I got home, my brother found me sleeping in a cotton crib, and it was in the fall of the year. It was cold, and I was very clean, well-fed, and they say smelling of honeysuckle, which was not in season that time of year. You see what I mean?
Yeah.
And as we were coming back to the house, I was riding on his back, one of my bigger brothers. I saw military vehicles all over the place, So my family never mentioned that I had left. Not sure if they were glad to see me, but for some reason, they felt I was all right. Now, how do they know? How did I know they would know?
Military vehicles all over the place.
Yeah, yeah.
And now, why would there be military vehicles all over the place at that time?
Well, I suppose they had picked up the ship, perhaps on radar.
There we go.
Had been there to check it out and to take samples from the landing spot and things, ask questions of people. Had my family told them that I had gone missing with these ships, then I'm sure I'd probably be in a petri dish at the Pentagon right now.
Indeed.
And my father didn't like talking to revenuers anyway because he did all moonshine, you know. So he didn't want to tell them nothing. During the interim, over the years, I've learned who they are, where they're from, how long they've been here, why they are here. Much of their technology, robotics, their sociology, physiology, their home planet, and its topography, what they have planned for the future. They gave me 144,000 circular symbolic configurations that you can see some of on my website. If you go to the coming up tan, I like suntan, thecomingup.com, and see these marvelous symbols that they gave me. Now, I'm not an artist, but I do not make mistakes drawing the symbols for some reason.
Yeah, I've got one from you, Riley. It's quite amazing looking.
Oh, wonderful.
Yes, indeed. You call me Qua Gyro.
Yes.
I love that name.
Mr. Spin-Around Man.
Indeed, so.
I won't leave without you this time.
I'm waiting for you to drop on in.
They give us until about late 2012. If we do not drastically alter the way we are doing things on this planet.
It's getting drastically altered right now.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. So it won't be a nice place to live anymore.
Right.
Yeah.
If they keep this up.
2012 keeps popping up all over the place. I mean, not just from the UFO side of things, but from other sides of the paranormal.
Yeah, my book was written 16 years ago. Within the last year or so, the Cassini rocket from NASA has been taking pictures of a great luminous object out near Saturn.
Which you had predicted that was there.
Well, I knew it was there. I've been there, you know.
And
it looks like a big Tiffany egg.
Yes.
It is 40 kilometers across.
Wow. And I've seen images of that online, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It is 40 kilometers across. I'm not counting the shields now. The shields go out thousands of miles.
Hmm.
But there are 7 intelligent species aboard that great mothership. And there are literally tens of thousands of extraterrestrials of all sorts there. On that great mothership.
So what are they doing there, hanging out?
Yeah, they are doing there what we would do if we could. Huh. That is, go and observe other civilizations.
Uh-huh.
They came here. They were having a skirmish, of kind of a small war with the reptilians over North Africa about 42,000 years ago. A few of them fell on an island out in the Mediterranean that you can call Atlantis. Somewhere in the vicinity of 32,000 years ago, they came down and started genetically mixing. They looked at the daughters of men and found them fair and took of them wives. Their sons became of old great men of renown. Now, if you'll read the bibliography of, say, the House of Adam, you'll find that some of those people lived 500, 600, 700, 800, 900 years among the ancient Hebrews and others, and they knew what a year was. You see what I mean? If they were able to build great edifices and civilizations and do animal husbandry, medicine, astrology, astronomy, and things of this nature, then they knew what a year was. All of a sudden, great civilizations start popping up, namely ancient Sumeria, then Egypt and Nubia, and others. You see what I mean?
Yes.
Building great edifices that we cannot even build now, gentlemen.
And I don't care what modern-day archaeologists say and structural engineers. There's no way.
No
thank you,
way.
Bert. There's no way. There's no way.
We could not do it with our. Can you please shut that bird up? No, he's talking about, you're giving away the secrets of the universe, you smuck. Yeah, you know.
Yeah, and there are other birds listening to radios all around the planet, and their heads are cocked now.
Right, and they're checking it out, you know. Okay, cool. They want in on this deal.
Yes. There you go.
They're called Biavians. They are from a planet called Biave. It is located roughly 450 light years from Earth. Mm-hmm. And what we call the Taurus constellation. They can traverse that distance one way in about 4.5 years as we measure time, which means that they have been able to accomplish 100 times the speed of light speed. The system of propulsion, the regular system, is a hydrogen-fed fusion core. It generates a median temperature of about 200 million degrees Fahrenheit. At this temperature, nothing, no metal, earthly, or extraterrestrial could withstand the touch of the core. Therefore, it has to be suspended in mid-chamber. The reptilians, the Tarxicians, they do this using sound waves and feeding in hydrogen. The Biavians are able to do this by feeding in hydrogen and setting up a kind of plasmic continui, so theirs is more stable. Now, it's not like a jet propulsion or something like that. Actually, what it does is generate the gigawatts of electromagnetic flux that goes out into super cold diodes that feed into anti-gravity buffers that sets up a kind of electromagnetic bubble around the ship. Now, by manipulating the electromagnetic poles, they are able to travel up, down, back, and forth through space and time. So when I was 18, in 1964, they came back and picked me up. At the time, I was a bare-knuckle fighter aboard the great ship, and he was saying, what is this pugilism you do? And I was saying, you got somebody up here, I'll whoop him. I'll show you. You know. So sure enough, they set up a bout between me and a hybrid male, and I took him. Because I found out that the reason I couldn't hit him was that he was reading my mind. And then I befuddled my head by singing a song inside, and then I beat him up. And so I saw some girls I thought were lovely women, but I only seen them in silhouette. And I said, well, hey, man, I didn't know you had girls up here, man. I said, I would like to meet them. He said, okay. And so it ended up with me having a conjugal visit with a number of hybrid females, that is, mixed human alien females.
Were any of them different colors?
On their skin, for some reason. There's an anomaly on their skins. Mm-hmm. I mean, the skin is smooth, but the anomalies looks like black spots or something like that, or blue spots, depending upon the skin color of the lady. But it was a very nice experience. I've not found anything that impresses me like Earth women. Now, I want the women to understand that, okay?
Oh, you're such a saber-tongued devil, Riley Martin.
Right. I want the listeners should go to my website, The Coming of Tan, T-A-N, The Coming of Tan, and get the book. You got to get the book if you want to know all of these experiences, because certainly if we talked an hour for the next year, every day, I couldn't download all the information to you.
That's one of the frustrations of doing this program, is no matter how long the program is, and it's been various lengths,
right.
we never have enough time to get through
it. Right, right. For the symbols, if I go to Riley, R-I-L-E-Y, Riley Martin, M-A-R-T-I-N, RileyMartin.org. That's another website of mine, and get your symbol, look at some symbols. Get your symbols, people, because there's a lot of benefits to having the symbols long before you leave.
You know what I liked, Riley, about the symbol was that you analyzed my signature, and then you wrote a whole thing, which was quite fascinating, about my past history and all my connections.
Yes.
It's amazing when people do that to you and they know nothing about you at all. And
well, you see,
yeah.
The same vibration you have now, you have had it throughout time, since time immemorial. You did not begin here on this planet, nor were you in here. And as far as actually ceasing to be, dying, that's impossible. We can change races, creeds, colors, even sexes, but we cannot die. We go to another dimension, and we'll end up coming back as an infant, as a child, And when you pop back up, you will show back on our neurotronic computers. I said, he's back. I said, watch him closely. He died owing me money. As soon as he get his first lemonade stand, I got to get paid.
And he ain't going to sell no lemonade for 10 cents a glass.
That's what I'm saying. So I have the ability for some reason and other abilities I've acquired that I never studied for or anything of that nature. I just have it.
You've certainly come a long way from a sharecropper's kid down there in Arkansas to where you got to now.
They befriended me, and they are nice people. They don't want to harm us, and I'm firmly convinced that they are not here for any nefarious purpose. I fear humankind. I fear what the evil men will do, not the aliens themselves. Because if they wanted to, they could shut the planet down without firing a shot.
Did it take you a while to get used to the look of Tan himself?
After a while, because I could feel his spirit, he was just a homie, my pal. I did not think him odd. He's odd looking, and they talk funny. But I detected no malevolence in them.
I read his poem when you had it up some time ago, and it was pretty fascinating.
They believe the Earth is in a lot of trouble. We have reached what they believe to be terminal saturation. But in their minds, terminal saturations, we probably could live with a while down here.
Are we going to have ET open contact, do you think, mass contact?
If we had studied peace instead of war, tolerance instead of intolerance, if we had used the full extent of our technologies to clean up the system and to go to alternate fuel sources and things of this nature, by the time we saw the face on Mars, we would have been contacted. They cannot trust anyone in power or in a leadership position upon this planet.
Sounds like intervention is necessary then.
Well, it would be nice, but that's not allowed.
No.
They can't even save us from ourselves.
Yeah.
Right.
Because if you allow that, then anyone who's got a bigger gun could go around saving people or taking them over, and they cannot allow this.
Yeah.
Mankind is doing terrible and diverse things out of greed and avarice and pride.
Riley Martin, our time together is about 10 seconds away from ending.
Right. It's been beautiful, gentlemen.
And it's
pleasure
been good.
To talk to you.
It's been good for us, too, and we trust it was good for everybody else.
Oh, sure. And we must do this again at some future time.
We
just
shall.
Give me a call.
We shall.
Absolutely.
And listen out for Riley Martin on the Howard Stern Channel on Sirius Satellite
Radio. And
also
on Artist First Computer Access.
All right.
Oh, there
Artist
you go.
First.
Artist
there
First
you go.
Computer Access.
You can get to Riley's serious information seriously at tonight's program listing. Wayne St. John, thank you, sir.
Thank you, Errol.
Thank you, Julian McNabb, Jim Pacheco, Riley Martin, of course.
Riley, thank
Dave
you.
Dave Furlot and David Cherniak out there. We'll see y'all next week. Good night.
Strange Days Indeed. Hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is...